through workshops and events. Again, that's episode 1, Brisk, by PDX Cocoon on Thursday, March 12th, 5 p.m. at Lola's Room, below the Crystal Ballroom at 1332 West Burnside in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
I'd sure hate to be left out.
Where is your radio dial on Thursday afternoons from noon until 2? 90.7 FM is the place to be. Twice a month, DJ Charlie presents the World Beat Connection with the hottest Afro-Caribbean sounds in Portland radio land. Reggae, salsa, soca, New Orleans Afro-funk, Haitian compa and rara, and Antillean zouk share the airwaves with African highlife, Afrobeat, Congolese soukous, Malian blues, juju, and South African kwaito, among the other great styles. Traditional and modern expressions are all included. On alternate weeks, check out Top Rankin' Reggae and Dancehall with Shocks of Sheba show, hosted by Teresa and Michelle. Any week, Thursdays at noon is sure to move ya.
Good morning and welcome to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host. Whenever I ask guests on the show who their influences are or what writers they are particularly excited about, there has been no name more often mentioned than that of today's guest, Kelly Link. From Karen Russell to China Mieville, she has become a touchstone for many, prompting Neil Gaiman to declare her a national treasure and for Michael Chabon to describe her as the most darkly playful voice in American fiction. Her stories have won the O. Henry Prize, garnered Hugo and Nebula Awards, and appeared in Best American Short Stories. Her collection, Stranger Things Happen, was a Salon Book of the Year and a Village Voice favorite. Her book, Magic for Beginners, won the Locus Award for Best Short Story Collection, and her collection, Pretty Monsters, was a finalist for both the World Fantasy Award and the Locus Award. Kelly Link is also co-founder of and editor at Small Beer Press, and its zine, Lady Churchill's Rosebud Wristlet, which between them have published work by the likes of Ursula Le Guin, Karen Joy Fowler, Maureen McHugh, Ben Parzibach, and Lydia Millett. Kelly Link is here today to talk about her much-anticipated 10-years-in-the-making new book of stories, Get in Trouble, a collection the Boston Globe calls ridiculously brilliant, and Publishers Weekly adds that Link's characters, driven by yearning and obsession, not only get in trouble, but seek trouble out to spectacular effect. Welcome to Between the Covers, Kelly Link.
Hi, my pleasure to be here.
Let me just start out with the title. I love the title, Get in Trouble, and the fact that it's an imperative that seems to implicate the reader. Is there a story behind how you arrived at that as the title of the collection?
I think at the point where maybe I had 2/3 of these stories and it became clear that I would have a collection at some point, you know, every night before falling asleep for about a week, I would lie in bed with my husband and we would come up with really dumb titles for collections. One of them was novel. One was, you know, just random sort of silly ideas, which because we were on the point of falling asleep was a lot of fun to do. When I began thinking seriously about a title for the collection, when we were getting ready to send it out to people, editors to take a look, there wasn't a particular story title that felt like it would work for a coherent whole. But it was really hard not to notice that all of the characters in the stories were people who got into messes. And so I started thinking about that you know, the folk saying, the devil finds work for idle hands. And so thought about find work for idle hands, which felt fancy. And in fact, there's a Donald Ray Pollock collection, or novel rather, that has a similar title. And so sort of boiled that idea down to Get in Trouble. And that seemed to fit the characters.
Well, in doing preparation for today and reading other interviews that discuss the theories behind what might unify some of these stories to be all part of the same collection, I haven't come across my experience as a reader of what I thought was one of the through lines for Get in Trouble. So I wanted to propose it and see what you thought about
all right.
So as I was reading Get in Trouble, the thing that really jumped out at me that kept reoccurring is this idea of doubles and doubling and doppelgangers. So we have people with two shadows. We have a ghost story with two identical haunted houses. We have a surrogate mother. We have surrogate animatronic boyfriends. We have faces that act as avatars in a story. And we have Marine, the operating system of a ship, who also sort of acts as a double consciousness for people as well. Do you feel like that's something that is part of Get in Trouble? And is that a fascination of yours in when you're writing stories?
Yes, absolutely. I think very early on I wrote a story with twins in it, a ghost story. And after I wrote that story, I was always really a little sad because I really couldn't do too much else with twins. I've done it occasionally, but you know, you use something that you like a lot as an item in a story, and then you can't keep on doing it. Instead, you do it in sort of different ways. So there are a ton of doppelgangers in this book.
What do you think that doubling does for narration for you? What sort of effect is it? Is it lending a story?
You know, in a story, if you have a doppelganger, it creates a kind of useful uncertainty. There's kind of a shiftiness. You know, traits may move back and forth, or people may take on each other's roles, and it makes the ground maybe a little bit shiftier too under the reader's feet, which could be a bad thing. But if you're doing it intentionally, you can certainly use it to make a story that much spookier. And I do think in general, there's already always a kind of doubling that goes on in a story anyways, because the reader, there's the kind of identification that goes on between the reader and the writer, maybe the things that the writer wants you to experience that then you do experience. So you're kind of a shadow for the writer in that moment. And then there's the kind of associations or attachments that people have to the characters in a story, and maybe the moments in which you separate a little bit and you think, I wouldn't do that, or I don't like this person anymore, or, you know, you pull back a little bit. And so that kind of identification or doubling, or maybe then separation at certain points is, you know, part of writing a story is figuring out how to make a reader attach or pull back or sort of progress through a series of emotions about a story or a set of characters.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned that it's sort of inherent to writing itself, because it also feels like the reader's wonderment about the writer's life outside of the story is a sense of doubling that haunts the story too, even when there's nothing necessarily overtly autobiographical in one.
Well, I mean, even when, and I think often there is nothing directly autobiographical, but you know, stories still come out of certain sets of preoccupations that a writer has.
Right.
It may be autobiographical in the sense that it is telling you something about the interior life of people when they sit down to think about stories or narrative.
Sure. And another thing that's interesting in Get in Trouble is that a lot of the stories are have protagonists that are adolescent girls, and I feel like adolescence is an interesting doubling time in a sense, because you're part of two worlds at the same time, and you're not part of either at the same time. So it almost feels like a sense of doubling, but also disembodiment.
Yeah, I've been thinking about this a little bit. When I was a kid, my dad was a minister. He was a pastor. He then worked at a seminary, and then he ended up in graduate school. He got a PhD in psychology. And, you know, he would bring home his homework. A lot of his homework was learning how to give specific sets of tests. So he gave us, you know, these tests as sort of a form of practice. And, you know, we did the Rorschach blots and things like that. Yeah. And that was, you know, I think that was probably useful training for being a writer, because he would, you know, hand us the sheet and say, well, tell me what you see. And then we'd sort of say stuff, and then he'd say, okay, interesting, but wouldn't tell us anything. So it was, I think, this sort of confirmation that it was possible to see many sorts of things in an image or in a story, and that the point wasn't being right or wrong. It was just what you could pull out of it. And now I've lost the question. I think it was adolescence anyway. So, you know, I think one of the things about it's, I think that we are multiple people in our adult lives as well. You know, we're different people at work or with our family or with certain groups of friends. But I think the thing about adolescence is you're at a point where you're learning to become those multiple selves. And much of it feels very false because you haven't fully figured out who to be in certain kinds of contexts. And so there is that sort of weird, you know, you're trying too much or you're trying too little or you're trying out something that really doesn't pan out at all. And by the point that you're an adult, most of us have figured out, I think without thinking too much about it, who we are supposed to be in certain kinds of relationships. And maybe at a certain point in your life, you decide that you're not happy with who you are. Or if you're lucky, you know, you like the person you are at work and you like the person that you get to be at home. You know, that all of that is in fact very comfortable.
So in a weird way, there's the paradox of like looking for the mask that is the most authentic.
Absolutely.
Or the persona that is most reflective of what you want to be in that scenario.
Yeah. And I mean, I don't mean any of this in a bad way. I don't think it's a bad thing that we are not always the same people depending on the context. I think it's actually pretty liberating, the idea that you do not always have to be the same person. It would be kind of awful to be confined into being the same person all of the time. Or I don't know, maybe in fact it would be, you know, very Buddhist, very, very, to sort of be the same in every context.
We'll talk a little bit about the epigraph by Basho, the haiku, year after year, on the monkey's face, a monkey's face.
Yeah,
which feels like such a great intro to this enterprise of Get in Trouble to me.
Well, that's a poem that my husband read and loved, and I loved too. He went through a period where, whenever we were with a group of people, he would ask people to draw a monkey face. In part as an homage to that poem. So somewhere we have a big stack of drawings of monkey faces. But, you know, as far as poems go, it's, you look at it sometimes and you think, that is a really depressing poem. And at other points you think, no, that's just, you know, that's fine. That's the way it is. Monks would go around with monkeys. And in fact, the monkeys would wear a mask on this night, a monkey mask. Which is, again, you know, just that image is kind of really striking.
Yeah. In case you just tuned in, we're talking today to Kelly Link about her latest short story collection, Get in Trouble. Well, let's have you read a little bit from the collection so people can hear the prose and Get in Trouble.
So this is a small part of a ghost story called Two Houses, which is about a group of astronauts on a very, very long voyage, and they are having a birthday party and are now telling each other ghost stories. And this is one of them. At the time of this story, my great-grandmother was a girl of 8 or 9. She went to school for part of the year. The rest of the year, she and her brothers and sisters did the work of the farm. My great-grandmother's work was to take the cows to a meadow where the pasturage was rich in clover and sweet grasses. The cows were very big and she was very small, but they knew to come when she called them. In the evening, she brought the herd home again. The path went along a ridge. On the near side, she and her cows passed a closer meadow that her family did not use, even though the pasturage looked very fine to my great-grandmother. There was a brook down in the meadow and an old tree. There was a rock under the tree, a great slab that looked something like a table. My great-grandmother didn't like that meadow. Sometimes when she looked down, she saw people sitting around the table that the rock made. They were eating and drinking. They wore old-fashioned clothing, the kind her own great-grandmother would have worn. She knew that they had been dead a very long time. One day, my great-grandmother was leading her cows home, and she looked down into the meadow. She saw the people eating and drinking at their table. And while she was looking down, they turned and looked at her. They began to wave at her to beckon that she should come down and sit with them and eat and drink. But instead, she turned away and went home and told her mother what had happened. And after that, her older brother, who was a very unimaginative boy, had the job of taking the cattle to the far pasture.
We've been listening to Kelly Link read from her latest collection, Get in Trouble. You've talked before about how stories can operate under daytime logic and nighttime logic. Can you talk about that in relationship to these stories? What is nighttime logic and how are you implementing that in the stories that you write?
These are terms that there's a writer, Howard Waldrop, came up with. He's mostly a short story writer. And so the difference, according to Howard, is that daytime logic is kind of everyday logic. It's, you know, you sort of set your alarm and the alarm goes off at a specific time, and your day sort of happens. And if things go wrong, if the coffee machine breaks or something like that, you know, there's no sort of feeling, you don't have a feeling of unease about it. And with nighttime logic, I think in life or in a story, there's kind of a pattern that you feel, maybe intuitively, and there does appear to be a logic to it, but it is not the logic of alarms going off and coffee machines breaking and sort of with nighttime logic with stories. You may not understand the progression of the story, but you feel that there's a sense, a guiding sensibility behind it.
Hmm. You're a writer who has a lot of crossover appeal between straight sci-fi fantasy readers who only read sci-fi and readers who never read sci-fi fantasy who read you also. And I've been wondering about that phenomenon and wondering if it's partly related to this doubling phenomenon also. On the one hand, that you foreground the ways in which the everyday is really weird. And then when you portray things that are really fantastical, you portray them as very ordinary, often within a story. And it feels like, in a way, you're surprising people around their expectations in both senses. But I was curious how useful you feel like these genre distinctions are. You are definitely straddling worlds that, you know, only have somewhat of a Venn diagram overlap, but are they useful to you?
Yes and no. I mean, science fiction, fantasy, horror versus sort of the fiction that you find in the fiction section of a bookstore. You're going to find some surreal or fantastic stuff in fiction. Anyway, so there's already a kind of seepage.
Well, what about in terms of, are you conscious of writing within a specific trope and then maybe trying to change the expectations around it as you're writing in it?
No, I think actually that this is my failure to write heart of genre stuff. You know, I did grow up reading fantasy and science fiction, and the places where I wanted to sell my work to were the pulpy genre magazines, which I still love a great deal, Asimov's and the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction. But I have a very hard time writing it. I guess what would be, to me, they seem like very straightforward ghost stories, but they don't quite fit into that slot sometimes. Mm. You know, I have been published in those magazines, but that took some work, you know, because in fact, the stories did not feel like straightforward genre stories to the editors who were buying the stories. I think that part of it is just marketing. It seems to be a weird distinction between audiences for fiction and, you know, movie-going audiences, for example, that people will go see superhero movies and they will see dramas or thrillers or romantic comedies or even young adult movies and don't really think twice about it. But when people read books, sometimes they really feel that they're supposed to stay on one side of the divide, which is a strange phenomenon to me.
Yeah.
And so, you know, my goal, at least with the people that I know are my friends, is always to get them to read stuff that I think that they would like if they were reading a little bit farther afield. Mm-hmm. So I have a couple of people that I think of as my test group that I will give science fiction or fantasy books too, and see what they think. And I often start with young adult fantasy, that seems to be a great gateway to getting them to read more genre work.
Right. Well, it's interesting you talking about wanting to write a certain way, and then not the way you're writing turned out was different than what your original intentions were. There's this interview you just did for the Millions website, and part of it, one of the pieces of advice you gave to writers is sort of gone viral on the internet.
Ooh.
While you've been on tour. Yeah. But it said, lean on what you do well. Being well-rounded as a writer isn't the goal. I would love for you to elaborate on that sentiment, and maybe if you could just touch on some of the ways in which you realized these are my strengths and these are the things that I don't do as well and I'm just not going to do them.
I can probably complicate that advice a little bit. When I say lean on what you do well, what I also mean is you have to use that to compensate for the other stuff. It's not as if you can think, well, I'm great at, you know, really descriptive, evocative passages, so I should concentrate on that and skip characterization altogether. You know, you have to find a way to make the stuff that you're good at work for characterization as well. And I thought for a long time, I'm not sure what I think now, that I was not particularly good at plot. Couldn't actually figure out what plot was. So I sort of avoided, you know, filling in what seemed to me to be the plotty bits of stories, sort of sped up around them, or, you know, sort of pulled back, especially in endings, and tried to find a way to make a story work without doing the stuff at the ending that just seemed to me that I just didn't really want to do. I was really weird about, endings seemed very strange to me. The idea that you were supposed to tie everything off neatly. And so I had to find a way to leave a very open-ended ending in such a way that it was not incredibly frustrating to all readers. You know, I think there are probably still people who are enormously unhappy with how my stories end, but other people seem to be okay with it.
Well, I think part of the reason why there's such an appeal to the quote that is traveling around is that there's a sense of liberation, that you don't have to be symmetrically good at every aspect. When we had George Saunders on, he was talking about how he was really good at voice, and when he finally realized that if he just leaned into voice, he could get everything else eventually. He doesn't have much setting. He does have setting, but it's...
I'll pick characterization or plot because those are things typically that make people very uncomfortable when they start writing out, when they start out writing. So maybe if you really suck at characterization, you know, figure out a different way to put characters together, to convey them on the page.
Can you think of an instance in this collection of a story that came from pushing into an area that you really don't normally want to go?
Yes. So I'll give two examples. So in this collection, there's a story about two superheroes sitting on the side of a mountain. And I was feeling a little uneasy about dialogue, kind of liked writing it, but I was not sure. It felt, my dialogue was beginning to feel a little stylized to me. And so when I started writing that story, I only wrote it as dialogue for maybe the first 10 pages. And that was, again, dialogue is part of characterization. I was trying to find a way into creating, you know, two different people and making them seem really distinct from each other and only allowing myself to do that through dialogue. It was a lot of fun. I really like the people in that story, I think in part because it was so much fun trying to figure out how to convey them just with words. And when I finally hit the point where I needed to add some other stuff, I went back to the beginning and I added as little as I could that wasn't dialogue. Mm. And that ended up being a, you know, I'll probably do that again at some point. And then the other story is a story called The Lesson, where I wanted to try some stuff with paragraphs. And in part, this is because I am interested in paragraphs right now, but also because I was still thinking about a story that I read in workshop years ago by Jonathan Lethem called Press Enter, which I love, which is, as it turns out, all one paragraph, which I didn't realize when I was reading it. But then in workshop, people began to either sort of praise it or question it. And so I went back and I thought, didn't even notice. So I read through it and it seemed to me that in fact he'd pulled it off, that it was in fact one enormous chunk of text which flowed very naturally. And so for The Lesson, I thought, well, I'm going to see what I can do with paragraphs. But because of the sort of material of the story, even though at first I was thinking, well, I will make these paragraphs and in fact they will flow, then in fact it began to feel more appropriate to the characters in the story to jam things together in enormous paragraphs, even though you would not normally expect those things to all be pressing up against each other.
It reflected something about the people.
Yes, and the situation.
That was my favorite story in the collection.
Oh,
the
thank
you. That and Secret Identity. But The Lesson, it kind of blew me away, the paragraphs in The Lesson, because of all the things that you don't normally find in them, but how well it actually worked as is. It felt like a daring feat that was pulled off.
Oh,
as if
you.
It was effortless. But
I felt very dissatisfied for a while because in fact I was just jamming things together, and then I realized that there was a reason why I wasn't breaking them apart, but it's a very choppy feeling style. And so that was the last story I wrote for the book. You know, it's still sort of a little bit new for me to go back and think about some of the stylistic things that I was doing there and whether or not I think they're entirely successful. And so I go back and I think, well, that's really choppy. It sort of has a very weird kind of syncopated beat to it. And
but on
I
the
can't
other
decide if I like it or not.
And then but you have characters who are cut off from other things going on in other places also over and over in the story too, which is interesting. Before we end today, you mentioned that your short stories are lengthening, and maybe that means you're moving towards the novel form. Is that actually true? Are you aiming towards the novel form in the future? And if not, what are you working on?
Well, I have to write a novel. I signed a contract. Tried a novel for Random House.
So the pressure's on.
Pressure is on.
All right.
I realize part of the reason why I'm enjoying this tour so much is because I don't have to write a novel while I'm on it. And then I'll get home and I'll have to start, you know, looking at the stuff that I have. And
so you have started.
I have a tiny, tiny pieces.
A tiny bit.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. I'm not going to push you on that.
Thanks.
It was great having you on Between the Covers today, Kelly.
Oh, thank you. My pleasure.
We were talking today to writer Kelly Link about her latest short story collection, Get in Trouble. You've been listening to Between the Covers. I'm David Naiman, your host.
KBOO Community Radio is looking for qualified candidates to fill two vacant board seats. The KBOO Board of Directors invites qualified KBOO members who are interested in becoming a board member to submit a candidate statement no longer than 500 words, which should include the applicant's experience, information about previous board or coalition experience, and why they want to serve on the KBOO Board of Directors. Please email your candidate statement to Timothy Welp at kbucommunity@gmail.com by March 13, 2015. Candidates should also plan on being present at the March 23rd, 6 p.m. KBOO Board of Directors meeting to present a short statement about why they are interested in joining KBOO Board of Directors. Again, KBOO is looking for qualified candidates to serve on the Board of Directors. Application due March 13th and public presentations will be made March 23rd. More information can be found at kboo.fm/boardvacancies2015.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 25th Cascade Festival of African Films, happening Thursdays through Sundays, now through March 8th, in celebration of Black History Month at Portland Community College Cascade Campus. The theme this year is Africa Through African Lenses, and features the films Half of a Yellow Sun, Finding Fela, Lessons of Basketball and War, Under the Starry Sky, and many more. That's the 25th Cascade Festival of African Films at PCC Cascade, 705 North Killingsworth in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.